with production assistance by Michael Lipton, Lance Schrader, Chris Mead, Sam Porter, Don London, Kelly Lassiter, Jen Brown, Tony Patterson, and Sophie Alexander. Photographic services by Chris Morris. Promotion is coordinated by Mallory Richards, John Ingram, and Music in Motion Promotions. Special thanks to Mountain Stage members Walter and Sean Williams for their generous support. Lodging is provided by the Marriott Town Center Hotel, centrally located for the business and pleasure traveler in downtown Charleston, West Virginia. Mountain Stage was founded by Andy Ridenour, Francis Fisher, and Larry Gross. Why don't you go out and hear some live music wherever you are, just as soon as you can.
Major funding for Mountain Stage is provided by Bailey Glasser.
This is WHFR Dearborn featuring local and independent artists.
Right, we're going to do this old Beatles song for you now. I've just seen a face I can't forget.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported non-commercial radio featuring local and independent artists.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon.
Actually, today we have two very special guests with us. Anyone in the UFO community is familiar with the Travis Walton story. Travis was the Arizona logger whose 1975 forest encounter with a UFO was made into a Paramount movie, Fire in the Sky. Ignoring the warnings of his fellow crewmen, Walton approached the craft and was struck by a blast of energy from it and taken aboard. The crew was suspected of murdering Walton and making up a wild story to cover up for the deed until Arizona State Police lie detector test cleared them and proved the truth of what they had witnessed. This year marks the 50th anniversary of that fateful event, and there will be three public conferences to mark the occasion. It is now recognized as the best documented case of alien contact ever recorded. And Jennifer Stein is best known for her award-winning 90-minute documentary film about the famous Travis Walton story. She's been an activist in the UFO community for about 20 years as a coordinator and founding member of Mainline MUFON, a community educational service for the Mutual UFO Network in Pennsylvania. She has published articles about the UFO phenomena, precognition, synchronicity, the crop circle phenomena, and, of course, the Travis Walton UFO story. So we are honored to have them both with us today. Welcome, Travis and Jennifer.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Travis, I was just talking to Travis. about the fact that he was on our show several years ago. I didn't look up exactly when it was, but several years ago, if you look at the archives, you'll see his name there and told the whole story. But let's start with you, Travis. For those unfamiliar with your case, could you give our listeners a brief overview of the events of November 5th, 1975?
I was working with a crew of six other men. You know, in the movie shrunk the crew a little bit, but there were actually seven of us out there. And we had just barely left work and hadn't gone very far when we encountered this object hovering near the road. And I just assumed, like when we see a deer or a bear or something in the woods, that it'll take off and be gone in a flash. But when I got out and went closer, it didn't move away at first. And so that made me realize, my classmates, my crewmates were sitting there and yelling at me in colorful language to get back in the truck and telling me just how stupid it was to do what I was doing. I have to agree. At one point, it started to move. So I jumped down behind a log. And when I stood up to run back to the truck, I was hit by a blast of energy from the truck, from the craft, not the truck. Mm-hmm. I was unconscious instantly. And my crewmates said that I was thrown through the air 15, 20 feet, and they were immediately certain that it had killed me because they said my body landed in such a crumpled heap that I had to be dead. So the boss said that the crew were screaming at him to get us out of here. And so they took off. Driving down this really rough road, nearly tearing up the truck, getting away from there. But in the movie, when they get a grip on themselves and decide to come back, Mike, the crew boss, said, "Look, anybody who doesn't want to go with us can wait here for us." In the movie, the whole crew waited and Mike went back alone. Beats me how that added anything to the story, because that's not what happened anyway. What happened was they all went back and made a search, and my body was not where it had fallen.
Mm-hmm. And I'll add that the crew, when they were turning the truck around, sort of at the top of this Turkey Valley, they saw the craft take off. They could see it from above where they turned the truck around and where they were deciding whether or not Mike would go back alone or they would all get in the truck and go back. Mm. And because they saw the craft fly away, they said, "Okay, the craft's gone. Let's all go back and get Travis." So they
and later, back. Later we were approached by a hunter and a fisherman who separately had witnessed the craft departing.
Okay. So who, if anybody, from what you're saying here, who, if anybody, saw the beam of energy come down and pick you up?
Well, the whole crew saw the effects of the energy. One of the crew said he had glanced away for a second, but it was such an intense blast of light that it lit up the entire forest for miles, instantly brighter than daylight.
Yeah, okay. I think what David is asking is, when Travis was hit, it was very powerful. All the guys felt it in their bodies, and even the FBI hunting agent who was on an adjacent hill, he felt it and saw it too. So then the crew drives away because they think Travis is dead, and they think they're going to get hit next. While they're turning the truck around at the top of the hill is when Travis went missing. So we don't know how he went missing. We don't know if some beam picked him up, like we see cows and horses, some people have witnessed that. We don't know how they picked him up. We don't know if they came out with a stretcher, and then, that remains only speculation. There's nobody witnessed that. The only thing is they couldn't find him when they got back down. you know, 5 minutes back down into the Turkey Springs Valley, he was gone.
But so, somehow you got you were
taken aboard that craft.
Yeah. Okay. So in the movie Fire in the Sky, it presented a torturous scene with you at the hands of the aliens. Was that true or just Hollywood?
That was an embellishment, and you know, when the remake is done, it will, I'll insist that they stick closer to the real story. But it was definitely, in a symbolic sense, that incredible horror was, you know, definitely inspired by the scenes that they filmed. It was the most horrifying, shocking events of my life.
Yeah. Now, you may have slipped here when you say the remake. Is there a remake in the offing?
Well, it was in progress. It's kind of stalled at the moment, but I'm hoping to rekindle it. Mm-hmm. I like the way it begins the second time around. The first time, the movie begins with the crew fleeing the scene in a panicked stretch. In the new movie, it begins with a dazed Travis, and you don't know what happened to him. And, you know, that gradually develops.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there has to be, they're in production somehow. You know that this new movie, the remake, starts this way and that way, whatever. Makes it sound like they're in progress, right?
Well, it always starts with a script. It got to have a completed script and maybe one that's been approved. So sometimes you submit a script and they want some changes, and sometimes the writer approves and sometimes they don't, but starts with a script.
Very good. So there is a script.
In progress.
In progress. Okay. Also in the movie, they returned you by the side of the road, totally naked. Was that true?
That was not true. Metaphorically speaking, it kind of captures the ripped open sort of feeling that I had at the time, but I was fully clothed, and they always got to insert a little nudity and in the film, I encounter some, well, I guess they cut that out. Encounter some, a couple, also naked in a car, and they scream and I'm screaming, but fortunately they cut that one out. It was a horrible scene.
So here you are by the side of the road, fully clothed. Now what happens?
Well, I ran down into the town. I immediately recognized where I was. I would drive to work there every day, and pounded on the door of a building where the lights were on and nobody came. So I ran on down, yelling for help. I came to some phone booths and phoned my family. And then I just sort of collapsed. I passed out. I didn't wake up until they came to get me and collected me from that phone booth.
Hmm. Wow. It's an interesting story about that, too, because Travis was not aware 5 days had gone by. He assumed it was the same night, because when he got hit by that beam, he was completely knocked out. All he remembers is waking up on board this craft in a period of maybe it's 2 hours, maybe it's 20 minutes. We don't quite know, but he was going in and out of consciousness. And when he woke up, he realized he was not in a hospital as he assumed he was, and he was surrounded by beings.
Yeah.
Well, payphones are obsolete, but they're actually still there, sort of a local landmark.
Very good. I have to take a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM. Station Making Waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm your host, David Twitchell. We're speaking with Travis Walton, the Travis Walton of the Travis Walton Fire in the Sky event. And we're speaking also with Jennifer Stein. Jennifer Stein is a producer of the documentary, the 90-minute documentary on Travis Walton. So let's ask Jennifer, a more accurate account, actually, of the event is your 90-minute documentary. Jennifer, what was the inspiration for making this film?
Well, it was a challenge for sure. I saw it as the fact that why had no one done this to this point? Because it's one of the best well-documented encounters with a UFO experience like Travis had. And no one had bothered to do the documentary. And being that I was doing educational programming on the subject for MUFON, and because there was the Arizona State polygrapher who was involved, because there were seven witnesses to the UFO craft when it appeared, including Travis, and then six witnesses that saw him get hit. Now we know there were other witnesses as well on the Hill. And we had a number of police involved. There were over a couple hundred people looking for him over 5 days. Dogs, that had his scent of his clothing. He couldn't be found anywhere. Yeah. And the fact that in his encounter, when he woke up, he encountered two different species, most likely working in tandem with each other. It's an incredible contact story from 1975. And no one had bothered to do a documentary about it. And I viewed it as a challenge. I didn't even really know I could do such a good job. And I really have many, many people to thank, including my nephew, Adam Stein, who's a filmmaker. And he's worked actually with Steven Spielberg on some things, and he works with Disney now. So he's a great filmmaker, and he took my interviews. I mean, I started working on it like 5 years. I didn't know what I was doing. I hadn't really done a major production like this, but I started shooting interviews and reaching out to people and saying, hey, will you make, can I interview? Will you tell me what it was like for you? So I got Cy Gilson, Marlon Gillespie, Chuck Ellison, and all the members of the crew, thanks to Travis. And I gained Travis's trust. He was willing to work with me and let me do interviews. And then I started interviewing other experts like Lee Spiegel and Ben Hansen and Peter Robbins and Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Martin, David Jacobs, who lived in Philadelphia, where I live. So I gradually accumulated some wonderful testimony about who Travis is, what happened to him, why it's an important story. I dug into some archives, and before you know it, I had a pretty decent documentary and started putting it out in mainstream film festivals that don't normally take films about UFO encounters because they're considered conspiracy theory films, right? But it got started to get accepted, like in mainstream festivals like Burbank or, Orlando, and, not necessarily sci-fi, conferences or film festivals. And it started to win awards. And then we decided we would use it as part of a plan towards the 40th anniversary, and that was 10 years ago. So now every anniversary, we have tried to screen the film somewhere with Travis or do something, even if it was online. We did a major event during COVID online because his story continues to be debunked. You can go out and find podcasts everywhere and they say, oh, Travis didn't see the UFO. It was the fire tower he saw.
Fire tower.
Impossible because it's 5 miles away and you can't see it from the valley they were in. Fire towers are on the top of mountains, not in the Turkey Springs Valley where they were working. But that's people believe it.
That sounds like
Philip Glass.
Huh?
Philip Glass. Sounds like Philip Glass debunking.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. But no, I was going to say in England, Left at East Gate.
Yes. Peter Robbins' book, Left at East Gate. Yes, that was continually.
Well, it was a massive story, and it was probably quite a challenge fitting all that material into 90 minutes because, it's jam packed with very pertinent information.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, were those involved in the investigation mostly cooperative, or did you come up against any brick walls?
Well, for many years, the crew was steadfast by my side, even coming with me, various members, and appearing and speaking about it. But, gradually, things start happening. The people get jealous of attention and try to one up. You know, I felt sorry for him, you know, to be a part of something so intense emotionally and have people walk right by them to talk to me. And, you know, I understand where they're coming from. So,
well, you are the main character of the Travis Walton story. You are Travis Walton, for goodness sake, you know?
Well, even the movie Fire in the Sky does not make me the main character. It's Mike Rogers, the crew boss, because I was missing. And so it fell to him to be the lead character in their okay. movie production.
Okay. And
I will give Mike credit as well, quite a lot of credit, because I went into the archives with Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Martin doing research on Philip Klass. And Philip wrote and tried to coerce the other members of the crew, including Mike Rogers and Steve Pierce. Philip Klass even offered Steve a bribe of $10,000 to say the event never happened. And that was 4 or 5 years after the event. Wow. And Philip Klass kept trying to get the boys to take more polygraph tests with a polygrapher he would assign that would make it look like everything was fake. There were efforts to go after this case. It still goes on today. In fact, people who worked with Philip Klass brought up a big debunking campaign in 2021.
Really?
Well, you don't get much better than Arizona State Police lie detector experts. You're not going to one-up them.
Did you bring that up to the Philip Klass crew?
Well, you know, if you're willing to bribe somebody to say it didn't happen, you know, he actually took Steve out to dinner, tried to talk him into it, and it was a no-go, even though he wished he could explain it away. And the story stands as it was, spontaneous reactions to people as it happened in their own lives.
Yeah.
So the documentary I produced, it's called Travis, The True Story of Travis Walton, and it's back up now. I just learned, Travis, they finally put it back on Amazon. Because of the debunking that went on for about 4 years, Amazon gave you a message that said, this is an unverified story, or there are assumptions made in this, you know.
Well, so this guy made the word debunking famous, but it turns out that after he passed away, the FBI file was released because he was no longer alive, showing that he was cooperating with enemies of the United States in the capacity of his job as editor in chief of Aviation Week and Space Technology. So where were the secrets leaking from? This guy. That's what they were investigating. It's a huge file. I've got like, you know, 20 pages, but much of it's blacked out. So we don't know what Mr. Klass was up to, but he was definitely on somebody else's side or on the page of somebody else.
Well, I thought that I was told, Stan Friedman told me that he had proof that Philip Klass was getting paid by our government, be it the CIA, FBI, probably CIA, weekly checks to debunk this type of story and to keep it out of the press. So I don't know what you meant by enemies of America or whatever you said.
Well, when you're talking space science, you know, and technology, that's gets into defense sorts of questions too. Mm-hmm. And who could say that he wouldn't be getting paid from two different directions? You know, it's not a very honest person to start with.
Double A.
What what Travis is explaining is Philip did get in trouble with the FBI because he published some top secret material in aviation, space, and science. And then there was an effort going after him with the FBI files that how did he get this information and why did he publish it? Because it would be information that the Russians or the Chinese could have, you know, garnered from that magazine. So that was a legitimate case that Travis is speaking of.
What happened to Philip Klass as a result of that, or did he die before anything could be done?
There did come a point where, you know, his efforts were, he was actually incriminating himself with the kinds of things that he was doing. It was a very strange kind of a thing. If he's supposedly investigating my case, why did he never attempt to interview me even one time? The one time I was on Larry King's show and he came on a monitor from another place, and even then did not speak to me at all. Spoke to Mike Rogers, spoke to Larry King, but I was invisible to him. Now, that is odd. That's odd. If he was going to truly debunk this, I'd be the first one, you know. The news media could call me and get a hold of me, but not him for some reason. Strange.
Well, I don't think it's strange at all. I think it's typical of these
debunkers.
Debunkers. Naysayers is the word I was trying to come up with.
Your listeners might really love to Google Larry King Live with Mike Rogers and Travis. It's right before the film Fire in the Sky comes out, and Larry King has them on, I guess, because was it Paramount Pictures or Universal that made the
Paramount.
Film? Paramount. So right before the film came out, Larry King had them both on, but they had Philip Klass in a back room. So it's wonderful to watch this because Larry King, manages it well, but Philip Klass loses it. And he calls Mike and Travis, like, literally liars on the air. In fact, he curses in the show. It's quite
a TD liar. That's pretty much out of control. Why is he so emotionally connected to this? Very strange.
You got a paycheck to protect. Mm-hmm. What did you say? Guessing.
Probably, yeah. We suspect. I never saw documentation that he was on the paycheck, but I saw many letters between people like Edward Condon and Donald Menzel.
Well, those aren't the kind of documents they leave laying around. If he's he was getting paid, you're not going to find any proof of it.
But he was on academic and like aerospace organizations that Donald Menzel and also Edward Condon were on. So there were many letters back and forth. He was invited many times to the Mediterranean for a week on a cruise and a yacht in the Mediterranean. So there are many letters and correspondence back and forth. So you can see the close connection that Philip Klass had with people who were known. I mean, Donald Menzel, we now know, was the head of the NSA during the time when he was the chief astronomer at Harvard. So, and he had written a book debunking UFOs himself. So there was an effort to go after anything that had to do with.
And not just Philip Klass. There were other so-called self-described debunkers that attempted things. And one of them told a gigantic lie to Mike Rogers that Travis was going to confess to everything in this phone call. Well, his mistake was, I had recorded the phone call. I said no such thing. I said, I don't want to talk to you. Leave me alone. Goodbye. And yet he was lying and trying to convince Mike Rogers that I was going to betray what had happened. And so, you know, their ilk, judge the caliber of their judgments by the sort of moral vagueness they have.
Is that Ryan Gordon?
I might be. I can't remember his name, but probably sounds familiar.
So you played this recording of according to Mike Rogers, or who was it that was trying to say that Travis has admitted it's all a hoax?
Well, he got Mike Rogers to say that briefly, but Mike backed off from that. It was just he believed that I was betraying the truth for money. What this guy told Mike was that I had agreed to do it, but they just couldn't quite meet my price, but maybe he would, you know, and dangling the promise of money that was never going to come to say something. So Mike tried to make up some kind of vague attack on the story, even some personal experiences of his own, but he's definitely still alive and back on track with what originally happened. And Steve, the incident really happened, but he wants to believe that it wasn't from aliens. It was the U.S. government creating this thing. Steve has tried to explain away a number of times. Mainly he was furious that it came out that he was one of the ones who was crying when they reported it to law enforcement. Well, he was the youngest guy in the crew, and there's nothing to be ashamed of, you know. I cried, Mike cried, and, you know, he cried, from what I'm told. But he was so mad about that, he wanted to change it to clean up his record as a guy that could never cry, no matter how scared he was.
He was a macho man. He couldn't cry over anything.
Yeah.
Boy, involved in something like that, I'd be crying, bawling my eyes out.
I will add that what I tried to do in the documentary that I made is keep it as real as possible and explain that this event in many ways ruined many of these boys' lives.
Yeah.
Opportunities that did not come their way. There was excess amount of ridicule that followed them all of their lives, and it forever changed the social situations that they found themselves in. And they had to find a way to rise to the occasion and develop a sense of ownership of their experience.
Most of the crew never varied from what happened right up to the very end. I managed to locate Dwayne Smith. He was the newest guy on the crew when it happened, and asked him to come and speak with me online, and he agreed to it. And next thing I know, his daughter calls me up and said that he had passed away. Apparently wasn't in excellent health.
Let me ask you this. On board the craft, what are your memories? Conscious memories.
Well, it was hot. Uncomfortably hot. I don't know if that's a physiological reaction, but it seemed hot and humid and much dimmer lighting than I would have thought would be normal. I was lying on my back and there was a light fixture above me, but even in the dim room, the pain the light caused me looking at it was more just the overall pain I was in at the time. Some kind of injury, I thought, from the blast of energy from the craft. And at the time, I accepted the term abduction. I sort of agreed with the idea that this was part of their effort to, you know, take me aboard, was to shoot me with this ray. But now I'm thinking makes much more sense to me that by getting so close, an energy discharge from the craft that was unintentional, was fatal or nearly fatal. And they were in a position of needing to repair that. And no one else had the technology to accomplish that. Mm-hmm. So I'm lucky that they wanted to fix what happened. I mean, they could have just dumped my body on some asteroid. Then probably the crew would hang for murder, but, you know, it could cover up the incident much better. And that seems to be their modus operandi, that they try to keep as low key as possible.
What did these alien beings look like?
Short, hairless, huge eyes. there's quite a bit of artwork rendering these type of being, and I'm not so certain that that means they're all coming from the same planet or the same species. It could be that this is kind of an indication of what we'll turn into given enough time.
But there were human-looking beings on the craft, right?
Yeah, I was combative, and I think if there was some sort of telepathic manipulation or mind control, it wasn't working on me because of the freshness of my injury. Mm-hmm. And I was not cooperating with them. I had regained consciousness, but was still in a great deal of pain. Mm-hmm. And the only way to save me was to get my cooperation. And by bringing in this person, which it could have been something, an illusion they created, or a similar species, or some government agency, something, I was going to cooperate with, because I immediately viewed it as a rescue.
Yeah. So you say, you've mentioned government. A lot of people say the U.S. government is involved with these abductions, and the U.S. government has bases with them underneath it. You know, in my opinion, if the U.S. government has that kind of technology at their fingertips, I'm more afraid of the government than I am now. And I'm afraid of the government now. Don't mind.
Well, whatever technology, I think, this is just my own analysis for 50 years, is that they know a lot more than they're letting on.
Yeah.
But I think these big campaigns to demand that the government turn over everything they know is a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
We are in death grip competition with a couple of nations that would love to terminate us. And they don't know how much technology we might have harvested.
Yeah.
And we don't know how much they have.
Right.
There's no kind of a treaty that you could get them to, well, we'll show you what we've recovered, crashed saucers or whatever, and you show us yours. Because you could never trust that they were not holding back certain things. And I think
I gotta agree
there's
with
a great you. Deal of safety for us by them not knowing how much we have.
I have to take one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, Making Waves. And this is We Are Not Alone. I'm your host, David Twitchell. And we're speaking with Travis Walton of The Fire in the Sky, Travis Walton, and Jennifer Stein, who has done a documentary, an excellent documentary, on the Travis Walton story. So, Jennifer, what new evidence was unearthed in the documentary that wasn't in the Fire in the Sky movie?
Well, there were basically the main thing that Travis and I and Ben Hansen discovered when we were up in the forest in 2014 is that we knew there was some rapid tree growth in the area. Both Travis and Mike had discovered that before when they had trouble finding the site with a National Geographic film crew that had come out in the middle of the winter in a snowstorm, and they're trying to locate the spot. And even though they knew where it was, Mike and Travis both said, man, that the trees are just like, you know, three times bigger than the trees just before this and just after this. Like, why is this area so big? Is this it? Because the trees look too big. Mm-hmm. So following spring, Mike went back and started sampling trees in the 90s and realized that for 15 years after this incident, trees grew at a 33.3% rapid tree growth. So we had known that when we started the documentary. But in 2014, Ben Hansen, myself, Gary Hilton, and Travis were all on that rim, up on the Mogollon. It's called the Mogollon Rim, but we were in the Turkey Springs Valley on the hill where the incident took place. And there had been a fire there, the Rodeo Chedisai fire in 2003. And as a result of the fire, many of the large standing trees at the time when the craft appeared had been cut now, and they were like waist high, you know, like little tabletops. You could go around and sit on them if you wanted to. But when a tree is cut like that, you can look straight down on the top and see the tree rings. It's not like you had to take this little pie slice out, right? And then look at the pie slice to see, okay, is there rapid ring growth? And what we could see really confirmed that the craft had been there, because there were many standing trees in a circle around a tree that had been cut the year before. That tree was so big, it left a big, huge open canopy clearing where the UFO had been hovering. They called that the Nat Geo tree, because when they were there with the National Geographic film crew, they found that tree stump and they were like, okay, we know this tree was cut. That's where this craft was hovering in the opening in the canopy. So they knew they were in the same spot, even though there was a lot of snow on the ground in the 1990s. So we're back up there on the ridge in 2014, and we start walking around looking at these tabletop tree rings now that had been cut. And we realize all the rapid tree growth was different on each tree. The rapid tree growth seemed to focus in epicentrically towards where that craft had been, which had never really been quite well documented at that point. So we started going around photographing him with a compass, and we put that in the documentary. And that's also, I think that information is up online at the Travis Walton, the movie.com website. I've put a whole series of pages up because there's been so much debunking. If people want to go look up a subject, there's these short little film clips that deal with all the debunking topics on that page, and they can look at some of my raw footage. In fact, I put the interviews with Marlon Gillespie up there in its entirety, an hour-long interview with that sheriff who was the main.
Where can our listeners go to see this?
Pardon me?
What is the website or where?
TravisWaltonTheMovie.com.
TravisWaltonTheMovie.com
is the website. And there's a whole page up on all the stuff that's been debunked. Plus, there's a little section on what actually happened to him on board the craft. We did a reenactment of that with actors in the studio so people can see point blank every specific thing that happened. I mean, Travis only has this focused memory of what happened on board that craft or until he was returned, right? He's knocked out, then he wakes up, then he has this incident happen with these two different species of beings, and then he's knocked back out again, then he wakes up on the side of the road. So it's very clearly documented in the film, as well as a
good... You would expect that radiation would kill these trees rather than accelerate the growth, but... a member of our team discovered a scientific published paper measuring the accelerator growth that came from the pine trees surrounding the Chernobyl nuclear accident.
And those were basically...
Now, only that wasn't directional. The radiation that came from that accident was on the... sudden growth was pretty much uniform on each tree.
Yeah, but it was still a result of radiation, right?
Correct. And it was the same percentage, 33.3% greater growth. Really? And from sunlight or from an exposure, say like a canopy opens up because another tree is taken down, that growth would only be like 15% rapid growth, according to a dendrology department and any dendrology papers you read, not 33.3%. So it was definitely a much increased growth only for 15 years. After that, it scales back down. And that's what we precisely saw on that ridge. You know, original growth, then rapid growth, and it slows back down. And you could see it right on the top of the tree rings. So that was pretty significant to discovery.
There was no Chernobyl there in the forest.
In the Mogollon Rim, no. But the fact that was well documented in other places was significant. And we were really hoping we could get maybe like the University of Arizona in Tucson. They have a great dendrology department. Even the university up in Flagstaff in Arizona, we were hoping we could get some dendrology department down. In fact, I tried to offer them money to do some research, but they moved me by police escort off of the campus, even though I'm an alumni.
Really?
The University of Arizona. I'm an alum. Yes, I have a degree.
I think we asked the wrong person. Just a different, person there and a different person making the request might get it. Get them to look into it later.
Yeah, like a kid, if you can't get mama to say yes, you go to daddy, right?
Yeah.
So tell us about these upcoming conferences, when and where.
I'd be happy to. Thanks for asking, David. So because it's the 50th anniversary and because I now live in Phoenix and I run Sedona MUFON in Sedona, I'm hosting a four-day conference in October, October 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th. So it's a Friday night, all day Saturday, half a day Sunday, and Monday morning. And it's really in honor of Travis, but it's a UFO conference. So if they go to SedonaMUFON.org, they can read all about it. We're calling it the Skyfire Summit. We have postcards out about it too. And it's going to be a really great conference. It's going to be small and intimate. There's only going to be 175 seats available. And we have a number of speakers coming. Don Schmidt will be there. David Childress will be there. Ron James, myself, Stacy Wright, Melinda Leslie. And we'll be going over like the secrecy to transparency is what we're calling it. So why the 40 years the 80 years of secrecy on the UFO subject? What do we know about it? And then a meet and greet as well with the speakers. Travis and I will be doing a 50-year retrospective. Also at Roswell.
50-year retrospective on the incident. And that's half a century.
I hear you.
It's hard to believe. Then actually on the date of the 50-year anniversary, on November 5th, at the Sedona Film Festival, we're going to be doing two screenings of the film with Q&A with Travis and I. And I imagine maybe Dana and Luke, some of Travis's family members may be there. So we'll do a Q&A that day in Sedona. And then November 8th, we'll be here in Phoenix on the following Saturday doing a big program. And we'll probably have a banquet dinner at the Arizona Historical Society where Phoenix MUFON meets. So there are three different events. They're kind of different. One's a conference and the other two are film screenings with Q&A and really an opportunity to get to speak with Travis, take your picture with him and, you know, congratulate him because he's really withstood 50 years of total unnecessary, you know, ridicule and debunking.
So what made you come out of the closet, shall we say? You hid away for a while because of the attention you were getting. And then all of a sudden you said, I'm going back out and tell my story. Why'd you decide that, Travis?
Well, refusing to talk about it wasn't helping. It's not going to go away.
No.
And I felt the need to get out there and defend myself and to, you know, provide some balanced information because there was so much misinformation flying around.
Well, that's good. So here's a question, Travis. I'll bet you've been asked many times. Are you aware of any other alien abductions since 75?
Have I encountered other things?
Yes.
In my life? Yes. I think there's other things that were real, but I've always tried to stick to things I can document. There was one where I was coming back from a MUFON conference in Burbank, California. Jan Harzan had just become the head of MUFON, and Tracy Torme, the screenwriter on my movie Fire in the Sky, were both there. And when we left there, we were headed back up to hit the interstate to come back to, I guess that would be I-40, come back to Arizona. We saw this light coming towards us. It was coming from very far away, unbelievably fast. Nothing can fly that fast. It very quickly, you know, was visible that it was actually three lights. And when it got close enough, it was a giant triangle with this light coming from underneath each of the tips. But it was kind of coming from some kind of a recessed into the surface of this craft. You could see the craft. It was black, but kind of semi-gloss. My girlfriend was in the back. She could look up and see it. It came and it stopped directly over the top of us, then rotated 90 degrees to what would be its right, and then shot off towards the Pacific Ocean. Now, I would have never reported it, except that there was a website that was accepting reports, and there was like 15 other people that were reporting the same thing by the next morning. People who didn't know each other. They were. It was actually made up on a map with a circle and a number all around where we were that saw the same thing and described what we described.
So did you think that, think at the time,
would either be, a huge coincidence that it would stop right over the top of us?
Did you think at the time,
trying to say, get me to report it as a giant triangular UFO? Now, if it was some technology that our government possesses, same thing, get Travis to report it as a UFO or aliens coming and stopping over the top of us. Otherwise, it's just an astonishing coincidence that in, you know, such a highly populated community, it would stop right over the top of us and make a right turn.
Did you think at the time, here we go again?
My son said, Dad, should we pull over and take a picture? And I said, no, keep going. And I'm kicking myself for that. You know, why? I wish that we had pulled over and taken a picture.
I'll bet it wouldn't come out. Well, here are so many in investigation, so many. I tried to take a picture. It just was blank, or the batteries just died. And, they can't get a picture.
Well, I don't think these lights on this thing were like lights to see where they're going or to keep airplanes from running into them. They were kind of recessed into the surface, and they had a kind of a strange color and a sort of a shimmering effect to them, like maybe some kind of a lift thing. I don't know. But when it stopped, it sort of tipped up a little bit on the lead edge and then settled back, kind of a sort of a falling leaf sort of a thing for something that was that huge. To be able to accelerate that rapidly is just unbelievable.
What year was this again?
Do you remember? It's documented by the fact that that was MUFON and Jan Harzan's debut speech there. It would have been 97.
Was it in the 90s?
I don't know.
Early 2000s is when he came in. He wasn't even president until 2010 or 11, something like that.
Okay, so it was around then. Yeah.
But there were three of us in the car, and then all these other people that reported it to the UFO reporting site. And who knows, there's probably more. That's just how many showed up by the next day. My other son found the other reports.
So you had a sighting, at least one sighting, but do you recall any other incidents where you were abducted?
I stick to the ones where I have other witnesses. There's things that happen, but I don't bother to report anything that's just me saying so. So I have enough trouble with seven witnesses passing the police lie detector test. That's not enough. Well, just me saying, well, so such and such happened is, forget it.
So in other words, yes, I've been abducted again, but I ain't going to talk about it because I can't prove it. Do I hear you right, Travis?
No.
No.
Yeah, I will say no, David.
I only talk about stuff I can prove, but
There you go.
It was a very singular event, and I think by me foolishly getting close and getting injured, it was probably far more involvement than they want. My own theory is that they intentionally minimize contact for a reason. I think they have the technology that they could remain completely undetected with their visits here, if they chose. It's not like they slap their forehead and go, "Oh, human spotted me again. I better be more careful next time." I think it's measured sightings that are deliberate and intentional, and it's to guide us, I think, to eventually accepting that we're not alone. And people say, well, why don't they just land on the White House lawn and say, here we are, and here's a million years of technology for you? That would be so destructive. It would definitely be so destructive. You couldn't begin to calculate how much just having our entire energy industry vanish overnight would be the collapse of civilizations.
Yeah.
And for on a species that has at any one time over 100 wars going on, you think they're going to hand us that kind of technology? Nah.
I'd be hiding from them. I wouldn't want to. Throwing, you know, years ago, thousands of years ago, people saw these things too. And they landed, and then people came out and they talked to them. And they either revered them as gods or angels of gods, but they weren't afraid of them because what could they do? Throw rocks at them? But today, we'd blow their brains out.
Or try.
We don't understand them. We don't know what we're dealing with. And we have the weapons to protect ourselves. Against what? We don't know. We'll ask.
I don't think it's nefarious or deadly or harmful, because since this has been going on for hundreds of years, if they wanted to take over the planet, it would already be theirs. We'd never know what hit us.
So where can our listeners go to view the Travis Walton documentary?
The Travis Walton documentary is streaming on like 225 streaming platforms now. So
really?
Pretty much anywhere. It's on Amazon Prime. They can go to the film, TravisWaltonTheMovie.com. It's on YouTube. They can watch it with commercials on YouTube. It's pretty much everywhere.
I would never name something after myself, but that's what she named it, Travis.
Yeah. Travis kept saying, can't you change the name? We almost considered the Turkey Springs incident, but I figured it really honored Travis. That was my goal, and to kind of bring some recognition to what all these crew members had been through. So I said, look, it's your story. It should have your name on it. So very begrudgingly, I think Travis finally agreed.
But, no filler. It's a massive work. She had to work to cram everything in there.
Yes, like I say, I viewed it, and I think it's a top-notch documentary and very, you know, something we can prove, something they have proved.
That's
so
right.
If anybody has is skeptical about Travis Walton's abduction, go view the documentary. And try to find fault with the proof that they have. So
thank you.
The only documentary in which she interviewed the sheriff, the original investigating officer, who finally felt comfortable with acknowledging his personal opinion on the case.
Mm-hmm. And he shares his own UFO encounter as well. And that's on my website. So they can go watch the whole entire interview with Sheriff Marlon Gillespie. And the first question Travis asked him is, how about you come clean about what you've experienced yourself? And he did. And he told us about a very interesting UFO encounter he had himself before Travis's event.
And your particular website, Jennifer, is?
Well, the film's website is TravisWaltonTheMovie.com, but you can also go to SedonaMUFON.org and see about our conference, which is really going to be small and intimate and a nice time to experience Sedona and meet and greet new people. So only the people who really need to be there are going to be there, because it's not a big conference.
So I hope.
Well, you know, one little anecdote about our giant debunker trying to attack the case. He was claiming that Travis was never at that phone booth, that I was really hiding out in a cabin with my mother in the woods. Well, I spoke to my family by way of the operator, and she turned around and reported it to the sheriff.
Okay.
He sent deputies to that phone booth to dust it for fingerprints that very night. So that documents I made that call from that phone booth, which he was claiming, you know, I was really hiding out somewhere. So,
interesting.
That phone booth was, you know, I was talking to a guy that works for the phone company. And I said, you know, the phone is missing from that middle booth. There was three together. You know, it'd be more authentic as a monument if you had the another, you know, phone. He says, well, there's phones in our storage room over here. I'll go get it. And so he went over there and unlocked it and got this phone booth, his telephone, payphone, and installed it in there. And then he opened the coin box, and all of the coins were 1975 earlier.
Travis Walton and Jennifer Stein, I want to thank you both for joining us today. And I hope that our listeners can go to one or more of those events that you mentioned. Thank you again.
Thanks for hosting us.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archive shows. Or click on the Talk Shows button, then the We Are Not Alone button for the latest show archives. And please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomena. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Listener supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Listener supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Guys and dolls, you are at the malt shop with Daddy T here in WHFR, and we are going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the malt shop, where the jukebox is playing and the kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.